This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, my co-host Craig Blumenschein, on a well-deserved vacation. Coming up in the second half of today's show, the art and science of exercise. But we are going to start today with a philosophical deep dive into something that hits a little close to home here in public radio. And that is that a couple of weeks ago, and now former senior editor at NPR, Yuri Berliner, published an op-ed saying that he thought NPR had lost America's trust. And he talks about the concerns that he has in NPR's coverage of the Mueller report, the Hunter Biden laptop, and ultimately in the role of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in staffing, and what he says are the impacts of prioritizing DEI and the impacts on politics. To take a look at that article is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, for this month's Philosophical Currents, when we take a deep dive into a big news story.
Socrates, the only true wisdom consists in knowing that you know nothing.
I'm not aware of too many things.
Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure as always.
Let's get into this article by Yuri Berliner, where he starts talking about how he thinks that NPR lost the country's trust. What would be a sort of philosophical, or your philosophical reaction to the article?
Well, my first reaction was that it feels really inside baseball. It feels like academic philosophy at its worst, which is a very narrow discussion between a very small group of people who think that their point of view is the most important in the world and no one else is paying attention. And so I imagined in many respects the NPR office being very upset, but the office next door having no idea that the article came out. The second thing that I thought was how rich of a conversation it could lead to, because I think it's full of such superficial descriptions of the problem that every paragraph could inspire a whole new essay, because there is a real problem right now. And the real problem is that explanations have been labeled as liberal. When someone says, you know, oh, what you're saying isn't really true, it's complicated, let me tell you why, and you have to give a paragraph or two paragraphs or three paragraphs, people dismiss that as liberal, whereas people think sound bites and stories that you can summarize in one sentence, that's by definition centrist or even conservative. And so anytime any news organization wants to elaborate on the details behind the stories, they're already going to be pigeonholed as liberal.
Who do you think is the intended audience then, if you're calling this inside baseball?
I had two reactions. There's the cynical reaction, and then there's the more muted reaction. The cynical reaction was, to me, it felt like an audition tape. It felt like he was looking for another job. He thought there's more money in right-wing media, and so he's going to write an article that says, I'm one of you. I look like I'm one of them, but I'm one of you. Please consider me for your position. Now, I can't say with any evidence that that's true. That's just how it felt to me. The second part of me, the rhetorician in me, the person who's concerned with language, was really puzzled by the audience. Because on the one hand, he is allegedly trying to persuade people that NPR has gone awry, but he's doing it by using a bunch of old arguments that, as a general rule, at least 60-70% of the United States has dismissed. And so he's playing with words, and that leads back to that first cynical point of view that he's auditioning for something, because the language that he uses and the arguments that he uses, he discusses it as if it's completely self-evident, as of course we know this to be true. NPR said this, but everybody knows that the opposite is the case. And nothing that he said that seemed obvious was obvious at all. And in fact, I found most of it to be factually incorrect.
Give us an example.
So he says at one point that NPR covers the Mueller report, but didn't cover the fact that there was no collusion, and that then NPR went silent. But of course, the implication of that is that there were no crimes at all. The Mueller report did find that there was no collusion because collusion is not a crime. Collusion is a generic term for a lot of different things. What they did find was conspiracy, aiding and abetting. The investigation resulted in 37 indictments, 7 guilty pleas or convictions, and compelling evidence that many people, including Donald Trump, obstructed justice.
We're visiting today with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. We're having a discussion today about a recent op-ed written by a now former senior editor at NPR, Yuri Berliner. I'm going to have a hard time formulating this question here, but a lot of what he talks about is DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And he says that in the quest for more diversity, equity, and inclusion, NPR has lost its way in covering, in particular, conservative issues. I wonder if that makes the opposite argument true, that if organizations that don't include DEI, are they guilty of the opposite?
Well, let's do this in stages, because this is the current debate right now, and DEI has become a code word for lots of different things. And if you looked at the internet after the barge hit the Baltimore Bridge and the bridge collapsed, there were tons and tons of very offensive tweets that say things like, oh, the ship captain must have been DEI, right? And what DEI has become code for is what affirmative action used to be code for, which is, well, you get less qualified people in a job because we only want them for their color of their skin, right? So I want to take this in stages. The first is, what does he mean by DEI? What he means by DEI is making a concerted effort to hire people of different backgrounds, ethnicities, national origins, and perspectives, right? The only way to be against that fairly is to say, well, we don't want Black people. We don't want brown people. We don't want gay people. We don't want anyone who doesn't look like us, whoever us is, in the newsroom. That's what being against DEI means. It is in favor of a homogeneous organization that doesn't represent the world around them. Now, there's a second problem. And the second problem is, take a state like North Dakota, which has a 5% Native American population. Among that 5% Native population, there is less access to good quality schools, less access to medical care, less access to journalism departments, less access to lots of different things for a variety of reasons. That means that out of the pool of 1,000 applicants for any journalism job, let's say 5 are going to be Native American. Isn't it important that in North Dakota, we hear some Native American voices? Isn't it important that because 5% of the population is Native American, and because a very significant percent of that population was born and raised on the reservation, isn't it important that any news organization has a voice that can share the perspective and get news stories that non-natives can't get? Maybe people will talk to the native journalist, but they wouldn't talk to a Caucasian journalist. Maybe the native journalist understands the subtleties of language and body movement and the taboos better than a non-native journalist. And so all DEI is saying in that respect is, look, it's North Dakota. We need to make sure that we have someone of Native American on the origin on the staff. That's what he's objecting to. He's objecting to the intentional search for someone who represents what we now call marginalized positions. And it's so easy for those voices to get lost because you're looking at 100 different applications. And if that those five applications tend to be at the end, you're too tired to notice them anyway. So that's what he's arguing against. He's arguing against the idea that journalism needs to come from diverse perspectives, because when we want to understand the various different stories from around the world, we have to at least have somewhat of an insider's point of view, and that insider's point of view makes us a better organization. He says, no, it doesn't. Stop looking for diverse points of view. Keep things, he doesn't say what, so I'll say, keep things homogeneous. Everyone should look, sound, and act exactly the same from the same background. Don't try to change that.
Is he saying that, or is he saying, I'm concerned that there has been a focus on this at the expense of the news coverage?
You know, I'm concerned, Ashley, that you're a puppy killer, and I'm not accusing you. I'm just asking you questions, right? What, you know, how come there are never puppies around you? I see puppies around other people. How come you never talk about dogs? Are you a puppy killer? Now, I'm not accusing you. I'm just concerned, right? The language that we use has multiple layers. There's the literal aspect, and then there's the implied aspect. There's the stuff that's up front, and then there's the message that we are really bringing across. Now everyone who's listening is wondering whether you're a puppy killer, even though I didn't accuse you of anything, right? And so when he says, I'm concerned about DEI, I'm concerned that DEI is going to make NPR a lesser organization, what he's ultimately saying is, DEI is going to make NPR a lesser organization. And the proper response to that is to ask why. Why is DEI going to make your organization less? What does diverse perspectives bring that NPR loses by having those voices? That's the question that I want to hear him answer. If he were right now, I would say, okay, explain to me why having Native American voices in North Dakota makes Prairie Public a less reliable, less professional, less talented organization. What is it about including Native Americans that takes that away? That's the question I want him to answer.
Jack, in talking about representation and this whole idea of change and of reactions to change, in St. Paul, Minnesota, earlier this year, they swore in an all-female city council for the first time in the city's history. And not all of the women on the city council are white. And I'm going to read a quote here from the city council president that said, "Let's just say a whole lot of people who are comfortable with majority male, majority white institutions for 170 years of city history are suddenly sharply concerned about representation. My thoughts and prayers are with them in this challenging time." I want to talk to you about that idea of these institutions, so many institutions, were majority male and majority white for a really long time. And as things are changing, like, this is when you start to hear people getting upset. I mean, I guess I kind of want to ask an obvious but seemingly difficult question to answer about why do we get that upset about change to begin with?
You know, it's funny, you went a completely different way than I thought you were going, because the quote that you read is a really good example of the difference between what's being stated and what's actually being said. Because what's being stated is there are a lot of people who didn't care about diversity And now they care about diversity, and I hope they learn to live with this. But what's really being said is, you never minded when it was all men. Now it's all women. Bite me, right? That's what hope and prayers has come to mean. It means I don't care. I'm not gonna act a certain way so you can bite me. And there is a certain perspective in which I understand that response, because when an all-male city council dismissed the concerns that there weren't any women on them, it was very easy for many women to feel insulted and alienated and ignored and invisible. And so now it's the side is flipped. And the one thing that we have seen over and over again in history is that no matter how much you claim you have the moral high ground when you're not in power, when you're in power, you become a jerk and you take advantage of it. Over and over and over again, there has never been a group that hasn't exploited being in power. Now, what you actually asked was an interesting and different question, which is, why are we so unhappy or so afraid of change? And that, I think, is actually really at the core of some of these questions. If you go back last year or a while ago, you and I had a conversation about the difference between what does it mean to be liberal and what does it mean to be conservative. And the short version that I offered was that to be a liberal is to think that all else being equal, change is good. That we want, that liberals want incremental change step by step because the future is going to be better. Conservatives want things to stay the same. A reactionary who's farther to the right than a conservative wants things to go back in time. So just as an aside, the article we were talking about, the Berliner article, is textbook reactionary, because what he is saying is there was a time when NPR was glorious and now it's not and we should go back to it. That's textbook reactionary. But most people, when they have what they want, end up being conservative, because if things change, you're worried that you're going to lose stuff. If you finally have the house of your dreams and the St. Paul City Council changes zoning, all of a sudden you might be next to the landfill, and that'll be horrible. Or if you have a city council member who you are really close to and who takes your advice, you don't want them to change because the new person might not give you the time of day. Being a human being means living in an unpredictable world. And the thing that is the scariest to every human being is that what is coming around the corner is something that we can't handle and we can't control. And so that's why the status quo is almost always the thing that people will defend, because keeping things the way they are means less turmoil, unless how things are is disastrous. And this, I think, is why poor and marginalized people tend to be liberal and non-marginalized people tend to be conservative. Because if your today is horrible, you have to have faith that the future is going to progress to something better. So you adopt that perspective of someone who says, yes, please change, it's going to get better. But if what you have is either good enough or great, then you don't want a future of change. You want things to be static so you can predict and so you can preserve. And so a question that is really important in this discussion, independent of whether anyone read the article or not, is what is the role of journalism in addressing the desires for change or the desires for stability? How much do we expect our journalists to play an active role in either making the world a better place or keeping the world as it is? He wrote a superficial article that he knew was going to be dismissed completely out of hand by the NPR folks. And he wrote a simplistic article that he knew that the Fox and Free Press folks were going to eat it up and use it as evidence that they're right. if he really wanted to change things, then he's an editor. He has an inside voice. He could make those changes, and he could have written a really good, really interesting, really sophisticated article about the fact that what NPR, and he alluded to this at one point in one paragraph, you know, that what NPR is doing is diffusing its perspective. So each particular show that is now broadcast is one perspective, and the only way to get balance is to listen to all of them. He could have certainly made that argument, but he chose not to because he wasn't writing for the reader. He was writing for his employer and for his future employer. That's the ultimate problem with that article. He wasn't writing for the reader. He was writing for people who were going to hire him in the future.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Ashley.
Chester Fritz, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein on Philosophical Currents. He's also the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs every second Sunday right here on Prairie Public at 5 o'clock Central. Still to come on Main Street, the food of Passover.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The Schwann's Company has been delivering frozen food to households since 1952. The company's yellow trucks and delivery people are especially beloved by their customers in the Midwest. But Schwann's Home Delivery has since changed its name to Yellow and cut staff and delivery centers. Harvest Public Media's Elizabeth Rembert explores the company's legacy and future.
Since 1965, Mary Bartles has been looking forward to her Schwann's deliveries. She remembers her 9 kids excited to see the delivery man drive his yellow truck down the driveway.
They would get on the truck and climb all over it, and they'd all come in with an ice cream bar or something. And now I realize he was giving those to those kids out of his pocket because I wasn't paying for them.
One of those kids actually happens to be my stepdad, which is how I know that nearly 60 years later, Mary is still ordering ice cream, frozen food, and meals from Schwann's. And on this Thursday morning in Vermilion, South Dakota, it's time for another delivery.
That's the manager. Come in!
Nate O'Grady takes a seat at Mary's kitchen table. He's her delivery man now and says he has his own memories of Schwann's. As a child, he remembers the yellow trucks coming to his grandparents' house. And now he says he loves getting to know the customers along his route.
You know exactly what they want when you come to the door. You know exactly what they're going to order. Mary's going to get her peanut butter cups. I know that.
Mary says it's the great service that's kept her buying from Schwann's for nearly 60 years. She doesn't even have to get out of her chair as O'Grady checks her freezer for what she needs, grabs the order from his truck, and packs it onto the freezer shelf. Back in 2022, Schwann's changed its name to Yellow, spelled Y-E-L-L-O-H. Some customers, including Mary, didn't take much notice.
When did they do that?
The new name is inspired by the unmistakable trucks, according to Bernardo Santana, the company's CEO.
That's one of the reasons we kept the name as Yellow, because of the famous and recognizable yellow truck, to bring back and to keep this connection with our customers.
The makeover comes as Yellow contends with a much more competitive market. Danny Edsel, a co-leader for Deloitte's global grocery practice, says the food space has transformed since the company started in 1952.
You know, over the last 40, 50 years, we've gone through like several waves of evolution.
Local family-owned grocery stores gave way to big box stores like Walmart, Target, and Costco. And now it seems every company, dollar stores, gas stations, delivery apps on your phone, are fighting for your grocery dollars.
We're right in the heat of that battle. I think it's yet to be decided who wins.
Edsel says the companies who put their customers at the heart of their operations will probably come out on top. But Akshay Rao, a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota, is concerned Yellow's new strategy may confuse its devoted customers.
And so Schwann's had a monopoly that it has now said, to the best of my understanding, it has said goodbye to.
About a year and a half after announcing its new name, Yellow made another announcement. It cut 750 employees and closed 90 delivery centers. Its yellow trucks used to make deliveries in all 48 lower states. Now it serves 18. Customers elsewhere can get orders via UPS. Rao suspects Yellow's new brand and the cuts are part of an overall strategy to modernize its delivery service.
The whole rebranding, cost-cutting through the reduction in their workforce and so forth is part of a strategic shift, which is emphasizing costs rather than customers.
Yellow CEO Santana says customers are still the priority, even as they become more efficient. Plus, he says, some customers prefer a quick drop-off rather than small talk with a driver. But for Deb Kuamoto, whose Lincoln, Nebraska address means she won't receive deliveries anymore, it's a loss. Ordering from Schwann's and seeing the yellow trucks felt like stepping back into her childhood.
It's really kind of ironic because here Schwann's, they were kind of like the first grocery delivery. And now everybody else has kind of caught up to them. I think it's the end of an era because I do miss the drivers. I really do.
She says she'll go to the grocery store instead of ordering via UPS, even if the store's ice cream isn't as good as Yellow's. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Elizabeth Rembert.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of a public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. Still to come on Main Street, a look at exercise science. That's after this.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we wonder about the secrets of nature and meet the scientists finding the keys to the universe, like black hole maven Jan 11.
I think it's really important as a scientist not to put a belief system first. The whole point is to explore the unknown.
Come explore with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Science Friday. Listen every Friday evening at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. What does it take to be an athlete? And how much is natural athleticism? How much is coaching? What role do the parents play? Today, we hear from Professor Dr. Bradford Strand from NDSU's Department of Health, Nutrition, and Exercise Science as he visits with John Harris, the host of Prairie Pulse, which airs right here on our television service.
I understand you have a new book out, and it's entitled Optimal Sports Performance, Practice Smarter, Think Faster, Play Better. Well, simple. Well, tell us how the book came about, why did you write it, what's it about?
Yeah, well, really it's about helping people navigate through the process of developing their sports skills. And we talk about, in the book, we talk about principles of learning so that you practice smarter using principles of learning. We talk about technical and tactical skills and how you identify perhaps the one thing that can make the biggest improvement in what you're trying to do. Just start with that. Right, just one thing. You can't do everything. And if we're going to do this step by step, it's got to start with a baby step sometimes. The book talks about the mental side of sports and being able to learn to focus, eliminate distractions. And so it came about because of a struggle I had with sports and not being able to turn off getting mad very easily.
Well, you say that. I understand it came from a bad round of golf.
Terrible round of golf. In I was playing in a tournament, and I was playing very, very well. And the guy I was playing against in a match play was playing music on his golf cart. And I asked him not to, and he kept playing, and I kept getting more frustrated. And although I was winning, I could feel myself start to lose. And after about the fourth hole, I was up 4-0 after the fourth hole. I didn't win another hole, and I got beat at the end. And I walked off that course so frustrated with myself, so disappointed that I had lost the ability to stay in the moment. And I said, I got to figure this out. And so I started digging deep, and the result of that is this book. So I hope today I'm a smarter player and can manage myself better.
I've got some terms here or some things to ask you about. What are preloaded responses as it relates to sports?
Right. So if you think back to the football coach for the San Francisco 49ers back in their early Super Bowl days.
Sam Walsh.
Walsh, yep. And he scripted the first 10 plays every game. So the players go out there and they're not worrying about anything besides their play. Right? He's taken away a lot of uncertainty of what's going to happen. And so preloaded responses is, how are you going to react when something happens? We're going to preload this. So let's just say I'm getting ready to hit a golf ball and I hear some noise behind me. Well, I can still try hit the ball and call it in any way. I'm going to hit anyway, right? And every golfer has hit the ball anyway, and they step back and go, doggone it, I shouldn't have done that. But you hit anyway. A smarter thing would be to step back, regather yourself, and go through what has been your preloaded response. We're going to set this up beforehand. If this noise happens, you're going to step back, you're going to exhale, you're going to gather yourself, you're going to step back in, and you're going to hit the shot. So we want to preload those kinds of things as much as we can. We only have so much cognitive bandwidth during a game. And if we're worrying about everything going on and we haven't preloaded some things, when something happens, our emotions are going to dictate what comes next. And we want to take that out of the equation. And if this happens, this is what you're going to do.
I get that, but yeah, because you think about, I've seen Tiger Woods actually take a backswing and stop mid-swing for whatever reason, and he's able to do that and then back up and regroup.
Right.
What are action triggers?
Well, I think it's just figuring out what it is that you have to take care of. Right, we all have issues, and we have to figure out what those are for you. Like if you're playing in a competition, and I want to know what it is that is going to hinder you, and we're going to put some triggers in place to spur you to do something else. Make sense? So that's what the action triggers are going to be. So we're going to figure those out for you. So we're going to put action triggers in place, and then we're going to put preloaded responses in place. We're going to reduce the number, the amount of cognitive struggles that you're going to have. You only have so much bandwidth, and you're going to wear out if you don't do some of these kind of things. So we're going to do this so you don't have to think as hard when you're in the competition. It's preloaded.
Does this relate to any athletic?
Certainly it would.
Anything you do? Okay.
Right, yep.
What numbers are we seeing these days in youth sports?
Certain youth sports are seeing an increase in participation. Others are seeing a decrease in participation. And some of those that are traditionally widely participated in, like baseball, they're seeing a decline in the number of kids playing baseball. Some of the alternative sports are seeing an increase in sports participation. Lacrosse has a big increase in sports participation. I think girls basketball, obviously, because what's happening right now, the increase in girls that are going to play basketball is going to rise significantly just because of Caitlin Clark and the notoriety that she has gotten. Sometimes all it takes is one moment like that, and you impact a whole generation of kids coming into a sport.
So participation is up or down in the last few decades, you say. Some of it depends on the sport and the things that are happening in the sport.
Yes, yes. And when you talk about youth baseball going down, baseball used to be America's sport. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not anymore. Football, basketball, other things have replaced it. So as many kids aren't playing sports, playing baseball. And when you really study it, because of all the requirements to play youth sports, the travel teams, the tournaments, all that stuff, a lot of kids are just dropping out. They're not in it for that reason. And we're getting on a different topic with some of this, but it gets to be that, is it for the kids or is it for the parents, right?
Where's their involvement in this, and what are we seeing now?
Well, if you talk to any coach, they're going to say the parents are probably overly engaged with what's going on. And in youth sports, parents are coaching. They're traveling, taking their kids on travel teams. They're picking select teams. And so, I ask, what do kids want from sports? And it's the same thing that parents want from sports. It's the same thing that community wants from sports. What do each of these groups want from sports? And for a community, they might look at youth sports as an economic driver. And they host these mega tournaments. And we can brag about our cities doing this, and we want all these things. What do the parents want from this? And some of it's to live vicariously through their kids. Most of them want the best for their kids. It's how they're getting the best for their kids, right? Some of them are thinking their kid is going to become the next superstar, going to get a college scholarship. Well, very few kids get college scholarships, so that should be a non-starter right away, right? What do the kids want out of this? Fun. They want fun. And you can ask almost every kid playing sports. It's about having fun.
Kids dropping out of sports. Can you give us, what are the reasons? I assume it varies, but there are probably some key things of why kids do drop out.
That's a very good question. And nationally, there's a term called churn. And churn is the churn rate, how many kids drop out of sports every year. And you want that churn rate to be low. You want kids to come back, don't you? Mm-hmm. And if they're not coming back, what's not allowing them to come back? Why are they quitting? So that's what your question is basically answering, asking. And so they're quitting because it's not fun. Principally, it's not fun. So why is it not fun? Well, the kids want their parents at the game, but kids don't want their parents talking about the game afterwards. And you get in the car and you ride home, and the first thing the parent does is start telling the kid, many times critically, what they should or shouldn't have done. Well, why do you want to go back again? You don't want to go back, have to go through this again if you're a kid. So that's one reason. Some of the, you know, parents getting involved. Kids signed up for fun, and when it's become something other than fun, they're going to go find another way to have their fun.
It's hard to distinguish that at a young age, especially.
It is. You know, when kids try one sport, didn't fit. They try another sport, it didn't fit. And sports isn't for every kid. I like to think that when we talk about sports providing so many positive things for kids, it teaches responsibility, commitment, leadership, fairness, ethics, all these kind of things. If, in fact, it does all those things, we should try to keep every kid in sport for as long as we can. And I say keep the talent pool as large as possible for as long as possible. Keep as many kids playing for as long as possible. And so how do we figure out how to keep them there without quitting too early? And part of it is feeling safe. You want to feel safe in your sporting. You want to feel safe from being picked on, from being bullied, from being called names, from being laughed at. If you're not safe, you're not coming back. The second thing you want is connections. You want to have connection with somebody, connection with the players, connection with the coach, connection with somebody. If there's no connections, you're going to go find some place where there is a connection. Okay? So I think coaches have to make a very intentional, be very intentional in helping kids feel safe and feel connected. And then the chances of staying are increased.
So how important is coaching? Because I think that's what you're talking about right now. And what's your advice for coaches?
Well, coaching is very important, of course. The problem is in youth sports, most of the coaches are parents that are more than willing to help out. Many of them well-intentioned, many had been good athletes. But being a good athlete doesn't make you necessarily a good coach. If you go through coach training, you learn about appropriate practices, appropriate development for age, ethical practices, how to structure practices that fit the needs of the kids. You learn about arousal levels. You learn about the zone of development. You learn about teaching kids how to do stuff in context. There's so much that you learn in coaching education that you just don't learn by playing a sport. And so it would be great if we could get all volunteer coaches to go through some sort of coaching education program, but I'm afraid we'd lose a lot of volunteer coaches if that was something that was mandated.
So really, how has coaching changed over the years in terms of how coaches actually interact with or treat their athletes?
Well, in the past, you got coaches like Bobby Knight, for example, mm-hmm. who were a shining star, and people would model Bobby Knight's behaviors. And today, you don't get away with that, right? So, you know, at whatever college level is different than high school, which is different than youth sports, of course, and you treat athletes differently in each of those levels with you know, what you can expect from the kids. But I think coaches have become a lot more approachable by athletes. I mean, athletes are asking for things today from their coaches that they didn't in the past. And communication is one of them. Transparency is one of them. Vulnerability is is something. You can't just say, I'm the coach, you do this because I'm the coach. Kids want to know the why behind doing some of these things. So in one sense, coaching has become more humanistic than in a previous day where you had the dictator coaches and you couldn't question them. So I think that's been the big change.
So even though you teach and talk about optimal sports performance, one still has to be athletic, have some athletic ability to compete. How important is that? But also, it's not the only reason for success.
It isn't. You know, innate ability certainly gets you in the door. It gets you so far. And after that, you better work hard at what you're going to do. I say effort squared. It's not just effort, but it's effort doubled that gets you further along. You think of Tiger Woods, and many of us think we love to play sports. Tiger Woods has a whole different level of loving to play sports. And I might put in some effort to get better. Tiger Woods is putting in double the effort. So I'm saying effort squared in order to really become good at your trade. But there's also the intangibles that people have. How badly do they want it? How smart are they relative to the game? How big is the heart? There's a whole bunch of intangibles. The passion. Persistence is a huge thing because it's not easy. And when you become an athlete, you have these ups and you have these downs. And when you have the downs, it's easy to want to quit. And that's where perseverance comes through, and you just slug through it and you keep on going. So there's lots of attributes that you look at in trying to help someone become the best they can be in sports.
A lot of people have different levels of natural ability, I'll call it, but how important is routine in sports? Having a routine,
yeah.
Practicing,
yeah, yeah.
Getting sleep, eating
yeah.
Right?
It's essential. I have a website, and it's called 3CT Sports Performance. And the 3CT, consistency, confidence, commitment, trust. And so the first thing, consistency. Consistency, obviously, in your skill performance. And you have to do this routine over and over and over again to get better at it. But consistency in sleeping, consistency in eating properly, consistency in showing up and training. So there's lots of aspects of a routine relative to consistency. We have confidence. And if you can develop a consistent pattern, it gives you more confidence for when you have to do the event. And if you're confident, you can commit yourself to whatever it is you're going to do. I've practiced this a million times. I've committed to this, what's going to happen now. I'm very confident, and I just trust. It's automatic. I trust the practice. I trust the process. I trust the discipline, and now I perform. And then what happens, happens.
Why do some people perform better in big-time pressure situations?
Some of it is they have a mental toughness that's been fostered over time. And we talk about mental toughness in the book, too. And I think a lot of people confuse mental toughness and physical toughness. And they're two separate things. And I think coaches many times view physical toughness as kids being able to take whatever they want to dish out. Well, that's not really mental toughness. And so guys like Tiger Woods, his dad trained him from when he was a little boy in all different kinds of ways to be mentally tough. When I played high school sports, that was not a thing. Sports psychology really wasn't a thing. And now it's become a huge part of sports preparation and sports training. I talked to a world champion racquetball player who won many world champions. And I said, what's the secret to winning at this stage of a tournament? And he said, you got to get there enough times. That's part of it, right? You got to get there enough times. And when you look at NBA champions and Super Bowl champions and so on, many of them were there 1 year and didn't win it, came back the next year and won it.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Been great to have you. Me.
That was Dr. Bradford Strand from North Dakota State University's Department of Health, Nutrition, and Exercise Sciences. He was in conversation with Prairie Pulse host and Prairie Public CEO, John Harris. You can find all archived versions of Prairie Pulse on our YouTube channel. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Maybe you've been called a bird brain in your day and thought it was an insult. Turns out it's actually quite a compliment. Here is an episode of Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. I'm Lola Neal, and I'm a neuroscientist. We've all heard the term bird brain, a pejorative phrase meant to describe a person as stupid or foolish. But in neuroscience, birds are used as models to study many neural processes, as they have cognitive abilities comparable to those of the cleverest mammals. Birds have exhibited surprisingly complex behaviors that pique the interest of scientists. Pigeons can be trained to complete tasks, corvids like ravens and crows appear to experience self-awareness, and songbirds use syllabic songs to communicate with each other. Studying vocal learning and imitation in songbirds like zebrafinches has helped researchers explore how language is acquired, an important topic in human infant development and beyond. Much like how an infant's babbling becomes simple sounds and words, which then becomes complex language in children and adults, juvenile songbirds learn the songs of their parents with syllables as a building block. Over time, these syllables can then be rearranged if needed, for example, to imitate another sound they hear. Scientists are working to understand how avian brains process, remember, and reproduce vocalizations. Not only will this information help scientists and the public understand the complexities of bird behavior, it even creates opportunities to better understand human language development and acquisition. The underestimated bird's brain is an incredibly powerful tool for neuroscientists and has given us insights that connect humans and birds in new and exciting ways.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Violet Smith, enrolled member of the Spirit Lake Dakota Nation, as she shares about stories from her grandma.
I know my grandma used to always tell me stories, and she told me stories about how to put in a garden, and she'd go on with when it grows and keep it clean, grows, and then you dry a lot of it for the fall, for the winter. Because in those days, you didn't have stoves, and I guess so sometimes they have to cook outside. And she said, and our meat, we don't have no refrigerator, so we dry it. She said, we dry the meat and corn, peas, mostly all vegetables, and meat, deer meat, and sometimes even ducks, rabbits, she'd say. And she'd go on, and that's the way it, she said, you're gonna live with all this. When you do this, then you're gonna have your own children one of these times, so you gotta teach them all what I'm telling you.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's time for horticulturist Ron Smith. If you have a question for him, send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.